I'm Steve Norman reporting. More than 600 men, women, and children, mostly from Africa, who were rescued on the Mediterranean, are now in Spain. Their rescue ship was operated by Doctors Without Borders. David Noguera is the charity's Spanish president. I am happy that the journey is over, a journey that was too long. I'm worried for the situation in the Mediterranean and the closing of European ports. But, well, it's all good. They're here, they are arriving, they will receive high-quality medical attention. They are welcomed in a good way. Spain will offer the migrants humanitarian stays of 45 days while their requests for asylum in Spain or France are considered. U.S. lawmakers are expected to vote on major reforms to U.S. immigration laws this week. Meantime, the Trump administration defends the separation of some undocumented immigrant children from their parents. Senator Susan Collins, appearing on the CBS News program Face the Nation, said separating families at the border does not work.
From the experience of previous administrations, it does not act as a deterrent to use children in this fashion. And second, and much more important, it is inconsistent with our American values.
U.S. federal agents routinely separate families seeking asylum or attempting to enter the United States illegally. In Nigeria, at least 20 people were killed, dozens others wounded in multiple suicide attacks in the northeastern town of Damboa. The attacks occurred as people celebrated the Eid al-Fitr holiday. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Boko Haram insurgency is suspected. This is VOA News. At least three people are dead after a strong earthquake struck western Japan earlier today. Magnitude 6.1 quake struck just north of the country's second-largest city of Osaka, just as commuters were beginning the rush hour to work. Considerable damage was reported, but no tsunami warning was issued. A suicide bomb attack has killed at least 19 people, wounded more than 50 others in eastern Afghanistan a day after a deadly attack in that same area targeted government soldiers and Taliban insurgents celebrating a temporary ceasefire during the Muslim festival Eid al-Fitr. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the Saturday assault. The Saudi-led coalition fighting rebels in Yemen carried out more airstrikes on the airport and in the rebel-held port city of Hodeidah. The UN cautions a protracted fight could force a shutdown of Hodeidah's port as a time when the halt in aid risks pushing millions of people into starvation. Farhan Haq is the deputy spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
Our humanitarian partners are rushing to provide life-saving assistance to thousands of vulnerable families in the port city of Hodeidah, where fighting has escalated. Dozens of UN staff are in the city helping to deliver food, water, and health services. We estimate that 600,000 civilians are in the city, many of whom are dependent on assistance to survive.
Some 70% of Yemen's food enters via the port in Hodeidah, as well as the bulk of humanitarian aid and fuel supplies. Conservative lawmaker Iván Duque won Colombia's presidential election on Sunday, promising to rewrite the government's 2016 peace accord with the former FARC rebels. Duque defeated leftist, former guerrilla, and ex-mayor of Bogotá, Gustavo Petro, 54-42% in Sunday's voting. Georgia State University scholar Jennifer McCoy, also the former director of the Carter Center Americas program, spoke with VOA about Duque's promise regarding the accord with the rebels.
He certainly has spoken about changes, as has his mentor, former President Uribe. And, you know, I think they're particularly concerned about justice in the accords and what kind of punishment former FARC guerrillas would face, as well as their participation in the political process. So he has talked about not abandoning the treaty, but making modifications to it, particularly in the justice area.
Duque has said he wants to make sure those who commit crimes during the five-decade-long rebel conflict in Colombia pay for them. Get more news by going to our website. You can find us at voanews.com, and we're also available on the VOA mobile app. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, June the 18th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. A ship carrying more than 600 African migrants finally docked in Spain after being turned away by Italy and Malta. And in Nigeria, an explosion killed at least 31 people in the northeastern state of Borno. The blast happened Sunday in the town of Dambor. The East African Court of Justice says it will hear a case filed by the East African Civil Society Organization on Burundi President's move to run for another term in office.
For example, if it did not follow the procedures of arriving at that decision, that national court, our court has had instances where they have reversed that. They put their laws themselves, so they should follow them if they are abiding by the rule of law.
Yapnalis Okubo is the registrar of the East African Court of Justice. And the recently released book looks at Nkrumahism, the ideologies espoused by the first president of Ghana and adopted by Ghanaians after independence.
By looking at how it evolved historically and the differing ways that Ghanaians interacted with this emerging ideology coming from the Ghanaian state and the first decade of self-rule.
Jeffrey Altman is the author of the new book titled Living with Nkrumahism, Nation, State, and Pan-Africanism in Ghana. Those stories and sports are coming up right here on The Voice of America. The ship carrying more than 600 African migrants was finally allowed to dock in Spain after being turned away by Italy and Malta. The ship Aquarius, which is operated by Doctors Without Borders, pulled in the port of Valencia. The passengers were greeted by more than 2,300 Red Cross volunteers and other humanitarian workers, including police, doctors, and translators. The huge banner reading Welcome Home in several languages filled the arrivals with optimism and a feeling that they were wanted and welcome in Europe, a week after Italy and Malta turned them away. Some of the migrants had been transferred to two Italian military ships to avoid overcrowding. And in Nigeria, at least one explosion has killed 31 people in the northeastern Nigerian state of Borno. The blast happened Sunday in the town of Dambor. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but previous bombings in the region have been blamed on the radical militant group Boko Haram. Boko Haram is blamed for about 20,000 deaths since beginning its insurgency in northern Nigeria in 2009. A recently released book looks at Nkrumahism, the ideologies espoused by the first president of Ghana and adopted by Ghanaians after independence. Jeffrey Altman is the author of the book, which is titled Living with Nkrumahism, Nation, State, and Pan-Africanism in Ghana. He talks to Ricky Shryok about how Kwame Nkrumah influenced politics and society at large.
There's relatively robust sort of philosophical discussion about Nkrumahism as a political ideology and also as a decolonized way of life in many ways. But I tend to view Nkrumahism as something more than that even. By looking at how it evolved historically and the differing ways that Ghanaians interacted with this emerging ideology coming from the Ghanaian state and the first decade of self-rule.
What were some of those ideologies? Was it socialism? Was it...
Well, in terms of socialism, Nkrumah, as well as many of the first-generation post-colonial leaders, they looked at one of the fundamentally exploitative natures of colonial rule was the capitalist underpinnings of colonialism itself as a way to extract wealth from African colonies. They looked at the class relations formed by colonial rule, creation of certain classes of people that they viewed as extractive.
How did some of these ideas and principles, especially those tied to Pan-Africanism, how did they specifically affect the daily lives of Ghanaians?
A political identity that that was emphasized through a whole array of state-run institutions. The two most famous ones are the Ghanaian Builders Brigade, later renamed the Workers Brigade, and then the Ghana Young Pioneers, which was adopted from the Soviet Union. In these organizations, Ghanaian young men, young women, and school children, they would learn about African history. They would recite songs. They would undertake some self-help projects. And so what it meant for these groups of people, it became a sort of just a constant part of their lives, sort of what their relationship to Africa is supposed to look like, sort of through these state-run institutions.
That was Jeffrey Altman, author of the book, which is titled Living with Nkrumahism, Nation, State, and Pan-Africanism, Ghana. He was speaking to reporter Ricky Shryock from the East Coast of the United States. Even though cryptocurrencies are becoming increasingly accepted as both a method of payment, they still suffer from some negative perceptions in the financial industry, often being associated with negative activities such as money laundering, pyramid schemes, and others. However, Paxful, a Bitcoin startup company, wants to change some of that narrative by using cryptocurrency to support philanthropic causes. I spoke to Ray Yusuf, the CEO of Paxful, a peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchange. He tells me about how he used Bitcoin to support a social entrepreneur in Rwanda to construct a nursery school, a portable irrigation system, and a 1,500-liter water system. The beneficiaries of this project are 7,500 children between the ages of 3 to 6.
One day we found out wanted to build this nursery in Kiziguro in Rwanda. And once I found out about it, I told the guys, you know, like, yeah, let's do this. Let's actually build a school in Africa. And that's like the coolest thing in the world. You can build a school with three wells and like actually like help real people and make a difference in their day-to-day lives. Wow. And so I taught him how to accept Bitcoin and how to use it. And he was amazed. He was amazed how fast it worked, how simple it was. And boom. 2 months later, the school was built. Now it's fully functional. There's children in there being educated on a day-to-day basis, right? I mean, it's working. Like, it actually worked. And to us, it was amazing. And to him, it was amazing. And to every, like, now it's an actual initiative. We're calling it Built with Bitcoin. And there's other projects now that are being funded.
Is this the first of its kind initiative where cryptocurrency is actually being used for philanthropic purposes?
I don't know if we were first. We started this in like early September. Mm. I think 2 months later, something called the Pineapple Fund emerged, where this guy basically, you know, became a Bitcoin billionaire or something, and he was just going to give away all this money. I don't know. He was just giving it away as cash, though, because he was rich. But for us, we wanted to actually, the Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency itself, we wanted to teach everyone in philanthropy how to use Bitcoin and why it was so awesome. For us, it was an educational effort, especially like educating these charities to understand how Bitcoin can actually help them. And we did that. And other people are getting involved as well. Anthem Gold is sponsoring several wells there now. They're expanding out that network of water. And now and then Craig Wright of Bitcoin Cash, he donated some Bitcoin Cash as well. And now we're trying to actually get some solar paneling and power there. We're trying to get in touch with ICON. He has an initiative called Lightning Africa, where he's trying to bring power to Africa as well. So this is a whole initiative. We want to build 100 schools all over Africa and the emerging world. That's the mission right now. So we have one in the same village. We also want to build a primary school and a hospital as well. It doesn't have to be all schools. It can be hospitals as well. But we want it to be actual structures that will remain there, you know, and be working and make a difference in people's lives. That's the key here. Make a day-to-day difference in people's lives, an ongoing difference in wells, schools, hospitals. They accomplish that.
Talk to us about some of the opportunities in Africa in cryptocurrency.
Okay, well, there's four examples I like to give. So number one, let's look at Nigeria. Nigeria is the biggest economy in Africa, and it's also one of the most populous countries in the world, and the Nigerian people are extremely resourceful, right? So here are the challenges Nigeria is going through right now. If you're a Nigerian, the value of Naira, that's their local currency, has gone down by 90% in the past 2 years. Imagine 90% of your life savings gone in like a blink of an eye, pretty much. It's devastating. So people have been turning to Bitcoin just for something that they can, you know, preserve the value of their wealth. So in the beginning of 2017, many Nigerians had found PaxOne. They were just putting their life savings into Bitcoin, right? Their wealth, instead of going down by 40% in the year, went up by about 600%, right? They were happy with just maintaining it, but it actually went up, and that's all people wanted. So they put their money into Bitcoin, and then they'll sell it off at every month or every 2 weeks just to buy groceries, take care of expenses. And they can do that on peer-to-peer platforms like Paxful, et cetera. That's the first use case where inflation, you know, goes nuts, right? But the second use case is even more interesting, right? So in Nigeria, if you have a bank account, 20% of the people there do, even if you have a bank account and you have Visa or MasterCard bank card, they limit you, the bank, to $100 a month that you can spend online. So what people are doing is, it's amazing, really, when we watch like how Africans use Bitcoin. They find amazing ways to get around these capital controls.
That was Ray Youssef, the CEO of Paxful, a peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchange startup company. Uganda's opposition and rights activists have opposed President Museveni's directive to the judiciary not to grant bail and police bond to suspects convicted of heinous crimes. They say the motive is aimed at stifling political rights in the country. From Kampala, Uganda, Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
Last week, Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni told senior-ranking officials of the government, including parliamentarians and judges, that will not allow suspects of murder to be granted bail.
There is one thing I'm not going to accept anymore. Two things. Police bond. I don't want to hear of police bond. Somebody who is suspected of killing our people for no good reason, will give him or her police bond? No way. Now, the other thing, and I'm glad his Lordship, the Chief Justice, is here, and His Lordship, the Chief Justice, please, bail. Bail for killers is not acceptable.
President Museveni's remarks came just a few days after controversial ruling party member of parliament, Ibrahim Abiriga, and his bodyguard were gunned down in Kampala. Other prominent politicians, security personnel and religious leaders, as well as businessmen, have been murdered in Kampala in recent days. But Livingstone Sewanyana, the executive director of Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, a human rights NGO in Uganda, says the president's words are simply, in two quotes, unfortunate. He says the president should rather invest in ways to fight causes of crimes.
I appreciate the president's concern about the need to up staff on security, but that has to be done with due consideration to upholding human rights. The right to bail and the necessity for one to access bond are fundamental rights because our legal system presumes that everyone is innocent until proved guilty. So the whole idea of doing away with bail and police bond is not only inhuman, but also diversionary.
Winfred Chiza is the leader of opposition in parliament.
By a mere statement of the president, that is the policy. And it's the reason why everybody is running up and down to arrest members of the opposition. We may not be sure who will be arrested next. Maybe the next item on his plate is to say now all other opposition political parties are banned. So we have to fight hard to restore sanity and to ensure that multi-party politics prevails and that democracy stands.
Betty Nambozi, an opposition member of parliament, was rearrested hours after the president's remarks. Nambozi had been arrested after she made remarks regarding the death of Abiriga.
On many occasions, the executive has also linked the opposition to security, and it would seem that the whole idea is to undermine the opposition and, of course, to repress it by denying them bail and police bond.
However, Chief Justice Batika Turebe has said the courts of law in Uganda will disregard the president's directive unless a new law has been passed. For VOA News, I am Mugume. Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The East African Court of Justice says it will hear a case filed by the East African Civil Society Organization on Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza's move to run for another term in the office. The appellate court said in 2016, the first instance faulted on procedure of the case. Moses Havyarimana has more on this story.
In 2015, the Burundi Constitutional Court ruled that President Pierre Nkurunziza was eligible to run for another term in their office. Opposition members and civil society organizations argued that the incumbent president violated the country's constitution that limits a president to run for more than two terms in their office. Yufunali Sokubo is the registrar of the East African Court of Justice.
A ruling was given by the first instance division. The loser were not happy. So they appealed, and the appellate division recently made a ruling. In that ruling, they faulted the first instance division. In this case, they found a fault on procedure. So that's why they have remitted it back for the court first instance to go and reconsider that. We don't know how they will decide.
In 2016, the trial court held that while it had jurisdiction to interpret the constitution of Burundi and the Arusha Agreement, the court said its mandate did not extend to the interrogation of decisions of other courts in a judicial manner, such as being asked in the present reference. The registrar says that the court do have the mandate to do so.
If the decision of a national court in member state did not follow the procedure, for example, if it did not follow the procedures of arriving at that decision, that national court, our court has had instances where they have reversed that. They put their laws themselves, so they should follow them if they are abiding by the rule of law. So somebody would be coming to our court saying there was a breach of rule of law because my government has got this law and it did not follow this law. So this is a breach of the rule of law.
The Burundi government lawyer Nestor Kayobera said that the country is ready to respond to the case and that he is confident Burundi will come out victorious.
We are confident that this one is not a case of 2015 related to elections. We are ready to lose it in 2018 or 2019. As we have been winning other cases, even this one we win it. And we are confident. The treaty is clear. If you lose the case, you have to abide to the treaty. It's enforcing the case. By then, enforcing the case of 2015, I don't know.
Earlier this month, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza, after promulgating a new constitution in Gitega province, he said that he will step down as the president of the republic after the end of his mandate in 2020. If the incumbent president steps down after 15 years in the office, he will be the first democratically elected Burundi president to peacefully hand over the power in the country's history. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Thank you, Moses. And from Burundi, we go to Australia, where national security concerns are likely to result in Chinese telecom giant Huawei being blocked from a major 5G mobile wireless project in Australia. This is according to local media reports. They say that intelligence sources believe the company is a cyber espionage risk. But analysts believe that the move could further aggravate tensions between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner. From Sydney, Phil Musser has this report.
Australia's The Financial Review is reporting that Huawei will be stopped from helping to develop the next generation mobile phone network. The newspaper says that intelligence agencies are warning ministers in Canberra about the security implications of allowing a company with suspected links to the Chinese government to be involved in a project of such national importance. There's been no official comment from the Australian government, but the Federal Attorney General Christian Porter says laws are in place to ban companies from sensitive ventures.
There's a process in place and there is an ability to exclude an organisation or organisations from taking part in that process on national security grounds.
It was concerns of that type that prompted Australia to ban Huawei from taking part in Australia's new national broadband network in 2012. The Chinese technology giant has insisted it's independent from authorities in Beijing. Huawei Australian Chairman John Lord says the company remains in talks with Canberra about the 5G project.
Government officials have raised no real concerns other than to seek more information from us about the way 5G is being formed, similarities to 4G, how Huawei intends to take 5G forward. So we're not really getting any concerns expressed to us at all other than reports in the media.
Huawei has also lost a contract to build a 4,000-kilometre cable between the Solomon Islands, a South Pacific island nation, and Sydney, following rare intervention by Australian spy chiefs. They were worried about a Chinese company gaining access to Australia's internet infrastructure. Canberra is also hoping to pass foreign interference laws to counter alleged meddling by governments and individuals. The move comes amid rising fears in Australia over the influence of China in its domestic affairs. Earlier this month, media reports detailed allegations allegedly contained in a top-secret document that China had tried to influence Australia's political parties for the past decade, as well as every level of government. In response, Beijing has previously accused Australia of being anti-China. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And now to sports with Samson O'Malley, coming to us from Russia, where he's covering the World Cup. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson. We begin the sports with the latest update from the 2018 FIFA World Cup, which enters day five later today. Three of Africa's five representatives at the World Cup, Egypt, Morocco and Nigeria, all lost their opening group game, leaving Tunisia and Senegal to turn in some positive results when their opening game comes up this week. Egypt lost 1-0 to Uruguay on Friday. Morocco also narrowly lost to Iran by the same goal margin, while Nigeria was beaten by Croatia 2-0. Nigerian coach Gerald Rao says all hope is not lost.
We are disappointed because when you lose a match, it's not a good thing for us. We don't like. But we must recognize that Croatia had the better team tonight. And my young players made some mistakes, especially, again, on the corners. We worked so much, but the first goal is coming on a corner, the second one also on a corner. Yes, we have to accept this defeat, and now we have to win against Iceland.
Tunisia will open their group game later tonight against England, while Senegal will have to wait until Tuesday to have a taste of their first World Cup game against Poland. Ahead of the encounter with England, coach of the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia, Nabil Maloul, says his side is confident of picking a positive result over England.
We have young players. We have the third lowest average in terms of age for this World Cup. I don't know what happened in the last two World Cups. I wasn't there, okay? Despite the fact that we had best players, maybe very good players, maybe they didn't have enough experience. I think this time we are well equipped to play well in this group, even though I said that for me, it is the most difficult group.
Let's take a look at the results of the matches played on Sunday, where Costa Rica lost 1-0 to Serbia. Defending champions Germany were beaten by Mexico 1-0, while at the Rostov Arena, Brazil played out a 1-1 draw with Switzerland. And to a quick look at the World Cup numbers so far at Russia 2018, 11 matches have been played, while 11 yellow cards have been issued and no player has been shown the red. In the goal-scoring department, Cristiano Ronaldo tops the goal-scorer's chart with 3 goals, followed by Cheryshev of Russia with 2 goals, same as Diego Costa of Spain. And finally, fans of the World Cup have been enjoying themselves and enjoying the best of Russian hospitality. Some Mexican fans are so sure they will win the World Cup. Let's take you into their camp and hear what they are saying.
Mexico! Mexico! Mexico!
I'm David Rodriguez from Mexico, from the Monterrey City. I'm with my friends, with my brother, and with hundreds of Mexicans, thousands of Mexicans who are here in Moscow and all Russia to enjoy the World Cup. We have a lot of culture, you know, and all our culture is bringing here to Russia, and we bring color and life to the World Cup. I think the FIFA World Cup brings the people together because it's like a big party.
That's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Moscow, Russia. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you very much, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, June the 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good day, Africa.